Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you expect when you have a choice in something? Does your ability to select your own clothes or career or spouse always leave you happier than somebody who is told what to do? My guest today has looked at both how we approach choice and how the options presented to us can affect our behavior even when we think a final decision is entirely our own. Among her findings is the fact that having too many things to choose from can actually lead to a sort of decision paralysis, where we deal with worries about making the wrong call by simply refusing to act. So what facts do we need to make good choices, and how do culture, age, and life experience play into our ability to select what is best for us? Sheena Iyengar is S.T. Lee Professor of Business at Columbia University. She writes about all these questions and the science that explains them in her new book, The Art of Choosing. Sheena, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me here.
For purposes of this discussion, what is choice?
Choice, well, when we think of choice, we think of it as comparing amongst a whole bunch of options, whether it be yes or no or A, B, or C. But choice is more than that. It's also a cultural construct. It's something that we put on a pedestal and revere. It means freedom. It means everything that's good and wonderful in our lives.
And you came to study choice in part because the circumstances of your life had forced you to consider what it meant to be denied the power to make certain decisions. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I was born a Sikh American. My parents came here from India in 1972, and that meant that I was constantly going back and forth between two different cultural backgrounds. So at home, I was a Sikh, and that meant that you followed tradition, so that there were lots of different rules about the way you lived your life. So, for example, you could never cut your hair, and you know, you dressed conservatively. And, you know, when you grew up, you often had your marriages arranged. So my parents met each other on their wedding day. They said their first words to each other on their wedding night. On the other hand, I was going to American schools, and in American schools, you learn about the importance of personal freedom. I mean, you get to decide what you're going to wear and how you're going to do your hair and what you're going to be when you grow up. And my God, the idea of somebody else choosing whom you're going to marry, even if they were your parents, how could anything be any more horrific? And so I was going back and forth between these two very different ideas about who makes the choices and how important is it for you to have the ability to exercise personal freedom. That was one thing that really affected my interest in choice. The other thing that really affected my interest in choice was the whole time I was growing up and going back and forth between these two cultures, I was also going blind. And as a blind person, there were all kinds of questions that were constantly being raised. Is she going to be able to walk to school by herself? Is she going to be able to study science or math? Is she going to be able to live by herself? Is anyone going to ever marry her? And that meant that I had to constantly think about how my choices would be limited and what the possibilities for me really would be. And so there were really two different tensions that kept coming up. One was the tension between personal duties versus personal preferences, and the other one was the limits of choice versus the possibilities of choice. And when I grew up and started to study choice, I found that those are the two main questions that I often keep coming back to in my research, because I think those are the two tensions that everybody has to deal with.
You know, what's so amazing in reading the book, Sheena, for me, is that having been raised in this country by American parents who sort of, you know, were all ingrained to believe that choice is the only option, you present here, you know, different groups of people who seem equally pleased with the amount of choice and freedom they have in their lives. It's not necessarily a fact that all Sikh Americans are sort of looking across the classroom at the kids who can choose everything and assuming that they have everything the right way.
In fact, many people in different parts of the globe would argue that one of the big negative things about American culture is the religion of choice.
And in that sort of religion of choice, Americans tend to think, well, this is maybe ingrained in our love of democracy. But as you mentioned, your parents are from India, which is the world's largest democracy. And people there see no conflict between certain sets of social rules and constructs that affect their personal lives and their ability to make really strong and considered and measured political decisions.
Yeah, that's a great question, because I do think that a lot of times as Americans, because we were the in a sense, the first modern democracy, we tend to believe that this is the form of democracy that every democracy would naturally take on. Mm-hmm. And so whenever we imagine, say, going to a foreign country like, say, Iraq or Afghanistan and offering them democracy and freedom, we often think that, A, the idea of democracy and freedom comes in one package, and that, B, that form is so innate and so universal that there really is just sort of one brand of it. And in fact, what it is that, A, there could be many different brands of it, because essentially our form of democracy is a reflection of our cultural values, and the Indian democracy is very much a reflection of their culture and their historical baggage. And second, it's not something that we're born knowing how to do. We essentially learn it.
You studied even small children, some of whom came from, I guess, European-American backgrounds and some of whom were from Asian-American backgrounds. And you were able to really put your finger on the idea that, that choice can be seen either as something that you do for yourself as an individual or that you do to sort of benefit a larger group.
Yes, that's right. I guess one way to describe it is, you know, even though I grew up as a Sikh American and I thought I was really culturally intelligent and was certainly really interested in studying culture, when I was a PhD student, I immersed myself in Japanese language and culture and actually went to Japan to do part of my dissertation research in Kyoto. And I remember the first week I landed there and I was in a restaurant and I ordered green tea. And I asked them, you know, could I get a cup of green tea? And they brought me this cup of green tea, and I asked for some sugar. And the waiter, you know, starts whispering to me, saying, you know, you don't have sugar with green tea. And I said, yeah, I know, but could I just have some sugar with my green tea? I'm really sorry, but I'd really like to have some sugar in my green tea. And the waiter was really frustrated about this, and he went over to the manager, and the manager came over and said, you know, you're not supposed to have sugar with your green tea. I said, I understand that, but could I please have some sugar with my green tea? That's the way I like to drink it. And they had this long conversation, the waiter and the manager, and it went on and on and on for about 20 minutes. And then finally the manager came over and said, you know, look, I'm really sorry, we don't have any sugar. So then I decided to order a cup of coffee. And I got this cup of coffee, and on the saucer were two packets of sugar. And, you know, it's interesting because when I saw those two packets of sugar, I was like, what? My God, you know, they had violated my rights as a customer by not giving me the sugar I had asked for. So I really had this American model of what it means to be a customer. And that was an innate assumption that I held. And yet they were showing me that, look, you cannot order sugar here because that's a faux pas. And I need to protect you from making such a terrible faux pas of making a fool of yourself, making a fool of this restaurant by putting sugar in your green tea.
Is there something wrapped up in this in terms of how we approach authority and either buck against it or accept it?
Oh, absolutely. We're much more, I mean, that's part of our culture, right? You're not supposed to listen to your parents. I mean, the best thing your parents could do for you in this culture is tell you not to do that which they really want you to do.
As a parent, that seems to be proving exactly true.
You know, you mentioned those studies with the kids. I can't tell you how many times those American kids, when they were told that their mothers had chosen what to do, they were like, you asked my mother? They were so furious, even at the age of six.
And then the kids who were Asian American were like, oh, they would rather do what they knew their moms had sort of sanctioned.
Oh, yeah. The Asian kids were so adorable. They would come up to the experimenter and tug on them and say, could you please tell my mom and show my mom that I asked her to do? I did what she asked me to do. They really just wanted to get the brownie points.
Another thing you discovered in looking at kids is that, and I suppose this is, you know, maybe across every culture, but when we are denied something, it suddenly becomes just unbelievably more attractive to us. Will you talk about the robot studies?
Oh, sure. The robot studies, some of the classic studies, was actually done by my advisor, Mark Lepper. And what it was is that there was a special nursery school in Palo Alto called the Bing Nursery School. And these kids were brought into a room with lots and lots of different toys. And the experimenter said to them, you can play with whatever toy you want, but don't touch Robbie the robot. And in one case, they were just told, you know, I'd really prefer if you not play with Robbie the robot. In the other case, they were told, do not touch Robbie the robot. And it was very clear that if you touched Robbie the robot, something really bad was going to happen to you. And, you know, none of the kids ever touched Robbie the robot in either case. But what was really interesting is 1 week later, when the kids were brought into a room with all the same toys again and there was no ban on Robbie the robot, they watched the kids to see who would actually play with the Robbie the robot more. And they found that the kids that were told, do not touch Robbie the robot, went straight for Robbie the robot. Whereas the kids that were told, you know, I'd really prefer if you not play with Robbie the robot, they didn't touch it. They had lost interest.
Because it just didn't seem like something that maybe it wasn't so great after all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I probably chose not to play with it. I mean, it didn't seem like there was any major harm that would have come to me if I had played for it. So I must not have liked it enough.
Talk for a minute about the jam studies. This is something that you did, I guess, in supermarkets in California?
Yes. It was done at a grocery store called Drager's. It's located in Menlo Park, California. It used to be a really cool store. I imagine it still is. I haven't been there in years. You know, walking into this store is akin to walking into, like, a candy store or, like, an amusement park. It was this really cool store that had tons and tons of options, you know, like 250 different types of mustards and vinegars and olive oils. They had so many olive oils. They even had a locked case filled with olive oils that had, like, olive oils that were about $1,000 a bottle.
Wow.
So it was the kind of store you went to because they had lots of choice. But one of the things I found was that I used to love going there almost like a tourist. And, in fact, they had busloads of tourists that would come there every day, mainly Japanese tourists that would take photographs of everything. And I noticed that I would go to the store, look around, get really excited, and never buy anything. So I went to the manager one day, and I said, you know, do you think this choice really helps? And he says, absolutely, the choice helps. This is what brings the customers in. Said, yes, but does it make them buy as much as you want them to buy? And he goes, well, I'd be happy to do a study if you'd like to. And so we set up a little experiment, and we set up a tasting booth right by the entrance to the store where we either put out six different flavors of Wilkin & Sons jam, that's the Queen of England, or 24 different flavors of Wilkin & Sons jam. And we took out all the normal flavors, you know, like strawberry, grape, orange marmalade, so it only had the unusual flavors like Victoria Plum or Lemon Curd or Little Scarlet. And first we looked at in what case do more of the passers-by actually stop at the tasting booth. And sure enough, more people stopped when there were 24 jams, about 60%, as opposed to when there were six jams, only about 40% of them actually stopped. But then we gave them all $1 off, coupon, giving them $1 off if they bought a jar of jam. And on the coupon, we had a code that enabled us to track in which case people are actually, you know, bought more jam. And what we found was that of the people that stopped when there were 24 jars of jam on the tasting booth, only 3% of them actually bought a jar of jam. Whereas of the people who stopped when there were six jars of jam, 30% of them actually bought a jar of jam. So that even though they were more attracted to more choice, when it came down to making a choice of buying a jar of jam, if you do the math, they actually were six times more likely to buy a jar of jam when there were six than when there were 24.
Sheena Iyengar is my guest. She's professor of business at Columbia University. We're talking this hour about her new book, The Art of Choosing. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Business at Columbia University, Sheena Iyengar. Her new book is called The Art of Choosing. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Why do you think, Sheena, that having so many jams to choose from, they all probably tasted the same. Maybe the same original six jams were in that sample of 24. Why can't we then just say, okay, I want the lemon curd or I want the royal plum?
Well, what was interesting is, yes, indeed, the six jams were a subset of the 24 jams. We actually watched these customers when they went to the jam aisle, and there were two types of experiences that we observed at the jam aisle. There was one set of customers that would get to the jam aisle and say, you know, that lemon curd was great. That was actually one of the popular ones that you picked up. And they picked it up, and they went and bought it. It was like took less than a minute for them to make that decision. Then there was this other type of customer that would land up at the jam aisle that would deliberate. Now, that lemon curd was good, but, you know, that Victoria plum was pretty good, too. And, you know, this little scarlet is also kind of interesting. You know, I just don't know which one I should choose. And they would deliberate and deliberate. It would take about 10 minutes, and then they would decide. They'd have to decide later.
And so they just wouldn't, they'd leave it all on the shelf.
They would just leave it all on the shelf. I mean, part of the benefit of limiting the choice is people are better able to compare and contrast those six options and really figure out which one they're confident that they like, which becomes harder when the number of options become too many.
What do we know about the differences between, it seems that in the world there are people who are able to sort of forge ahead and grab something and make a choice and think this is good enough. And then there are other people who really agonize over, well, but is good enough the very best? And I can't be happy unless I have the jam that pleases me the most.
Yeah, that's known as the difference between maximizers and satisfizers. So maximizers are the people that are searching for the very, very best in everything. They're the ones that, you know, constantly surf the TV trying to find the best TV show, and they might just do that until their hour of TV time is actually over. And then there's the satisfizers. They'll just, you know, pick that which looks good enough. You know, maybe it's the show I watch every night, but, you know, I just want to kill an hour of time. And what we know about the two types of people is that the maximizers can often actually get a better deal than the satisfizers, but they're less happy.
Because they're never quite sure that they've got the best deal?
They're never quite sure they got the best deal. So, for example, we've done a study with undergraduates that were looking for their first job out of college, and that over about 2,000 different students from about 15 different universities across the nation. And we found that the maximizers indeed got more job offers, got higher salaries. They made they got a salary of an average of 20% higher salaries than the people that were the satisfizers. But they were less happy, and when we followed them a year later, they were much more likely to switch jobs, and they were still looking to switch again.
And I'm guessing is there any converting oneself from one type to the other?
I think so. I think we can train ourselves to sort of prioritize and say, look, I'm only going to maximize in these domains and satisfice in the rest. I think if one actually thought about their life and asked themselves, is it really that important to get the very best item on the menu when I go out to eat? Maybe I should spend a little more time just hanging out with my friends.
I want to talk for a minute about this idea in our society of choice as an expression of personal identity, because, again, this is not the case everywhere in the world. But in this country, we sort of see our choices as a way of showing the world what we value. Can you talk about
Absolutely.
That?
Well, everything we buy is supposed to be an expression of what we value, right? From our hairstyle to our eye color to the shape of our face to our makeup to our clothes to our watch to our jewelry to our shoes to how we speak to where we say we're from, whom we marry. Everything is supposed to stand for who we are, right? In the old days, it used to be that some of these things were just sort of dictated by norms or dictated by where you lived. But now everything is supposed to be a choice. And on the one hand, that's really, really freeing because you can actually become who you want to be. But on the other hand, that's really, really stressful.
Yeah, because I guess if someone then doesn't like our hair color or whatever we're wearing or what we've driven up in, then somehow that's like a really an indictment of our personal taste and who we are.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go first on the phones to Plano and speak with Sanjay. Hi, Sanjay.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, my question was, being myself originally from India, and me and my wife, we have always this discussion about choice, and I always say that choice is overrated, and, and I'm being the youngest in the family, brought up in a joint family, so I don't think that choice is that big a deal, and for her, it's a big deal. So is being a woman or being... youngest or the oldest in the family, will that make any difference in determining the choice? Or is the culture bigger component or your personality bigger component?
Sheena, what do you think?
Well, definitely your culture is the biggest component in terms of how much choice you desire. Let's back up, though, a little bit. We all want choice. I mean, the desire for choice is universal. And we need to have some choice because we need to be able to exercise control over our lives. So we're not saying that anybody is better off with zero choice. We all need some choice. The question is how much choice. And it sounds to me like you're feeling that you had the right amount of choice and don't want more choice, that beyond a certain amount, you're saying, well, all these extra choices, you know what, they're just cluttering my life. And perhaps your wife is saying that, you know, I want a few more choices in my life. That gender difference makes sense because I think that the gap between how many choices men have versus women have, particularly in the really important things, is still big. And that's true no matter where you go in the globe, including in the U.S., where, you know, women can often exercise more choice than some other parts of the world.
And I guess when you say women have more choices, you're talking about the decision to, if you have children, to stay home with them or not, to have children or not. Is that what you're referring to?
Absolutely. I mean, women have still fewer choices. I mean, we might say that a woman can choose to have a career, a woman can choose to have a child, but we still, as women, constantly stress about that choice in a way that men never do. If I have a child, what am I going to give greater priority to, my career or my child? And that's not a decision that men make in the same way as women make and still feel forced to make.
You have some fascinating research in here about how people feel after a major choice. And you look in this case at patients in different parts of the world making the decision to take a loved one off life support. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, we actually followed French parents and American parents who had just lost an infant. And they were all in a very, very sad state. And in France, it turns out that the doctor gets to decide when you pull the plug on someone's life. And in the U.S., as you probably know, the parents have to sign the ultimate consent form before the life support is removed. And we looked at what were the differences in the way people coped following the death of their child. And what we found was that the French were better able to cope with the death of their infant than were the Americans. You know, 6 months later, the French were saying things that sounded almost positive, things like, you know, Noah was here for so little time, but for whatever little time he was here, we learned so much. We gained a new perspective on life. The Americans, on the other hand, were saying things, I can't believe it, I can't believe it. I felt as if I was a part of an execution. Hmm. And they were saying things that illustrated that they were really tortured by having to make that choice.
And we should say that in the French system, families can exercise, they do have the ability to say to the doctor, after the doctor's made the choice, no, I don't want this. So it's not a matter of they don't have the ability to step in if they think the decision is somehow wrong, which is what Americans fear, I think, sometimes when we think about giving up any level of medical choice.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, sometimes in France, people do intervene, particularly on religious grounds.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Sheena Iyengar is my guest. Her new book is called The Art of Choosing. Let's go next on the phones to Laura in Colleyville. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I find this subject so fascinating because in so many cases I'm a maximizer, and in so many cases I'm a satisfier. Just as your guest said, you don't have to be one or the other all the time. But I was just thinking that it really defines who you are and who your friends are going to be, whether quite often, whether you choose to be a maximizer or a satisfier. And we've always had different names for it, like slacker, for instance, if you're a satisfier, and or an overachiever if you're a maximizer.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever looked at it that way?
We haven't really. There are some correlations in that people that are maximizers tend to also be really perfectionistic. And while that there is some overlap there, it's not as strong as you would think.
And so I guess since, as Laura mentioned, people are many things at the same time, you don't necessarily want all your friends to be maximizers or satisficers, and you couldn't find that if you wanted it.
And can you imagine going to dinner if everybody was a maximizer?
There's always that one at the table, though, isn't there?
One is handleable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from April in Frisco who writes, I'm fortunate enough to be able to choose among many things, career, child rearing, etc. Although the time limit is at its end, I find I have aptitudes in many areas. Each day I consider how I need to spend my time and what career I need to pursue. I see myself enjoying other career paths, and so I don't follow any. What advice would you give a person who needs to learn self-limitation?
I think you need to figure out what are your priorities. You're not going to be able to choose everything. You're not going to be independent about everything. You are inevitably going to have to be influenced by, you know, the people around you, what you're doing. So you pick those few areas, not more than five, that you really, really care about. And in those areas, about five, that's where you invest all your choosing energies. As I always say, be choosy about when you choose and let the rest go.
Yeah, sort of pick your battles, I guess.
Yes.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak to Jennifer in Houston. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi there. Actually, you answered part of my question with the last call. I'm at a point where I could choose to live anywhere in the country, and my fiancé and I are having such a difficult time making that decision because the possibilities are endless. And so I was wondering, based on your studies, have you come up with any kind of solution to narrowing down those choices when there are just so many choices? How does one narrow it down to make the best choice?
That's a hard one. One thing we do know is that a lot of times people decide that they're going to have that really big house and it'll be really far away at times from where they actually work. And so what we have discovered is that the longer your commute to work, the less happier you are. It's really important that wherever you choose to live, that you live near where you work. You want to create that synergy.
Which is so interesting because a lot of people assume they'd much rather have a better house, a better place to live, and a longer commute. But it doesn't turn out to work out that way for people.
Yes, that's right. It is the leading cause of distress for people.
We have an email here from Mel in Dallas who writes, this seems to account for high levels of happiness reported by very religious people. The limitations of choice imposed by some religions relieves the anxiety of choosing, and the reduced anxiety is experienced as happiness. And I know this is something that you've looked into pretty extensively, Sheena.
Yes. My very first study actually was done with members of different religious faiths. You know, it's funny because as a Sikh American, I thought I was going to find the opposite of what I found. I was on a mission to prove that you know, being raised with all these rules was definitely designed to make me miserable in life. And I decided to study religions, and I studied and surveyed religious members from fundamentalist to liberal faiths, so Orthodox Jews and Muslims down to Unitarians and Reformed Jews. And what I found actually was the more fundamentalist the membership, the happier they were, the more optimistic their outlook on life. They were much better able to cope with disasters in their life, like losing their job or losing a loved one, as compared to the members of more liberal faiths. And in fact, even atheists are more miserable than people who believe in God.
Do you think that obedience to, whether it's a religion or to some other sort of structure that makes certain decisions for you, is that a choice in and of itself, or is that an avoidance of choice?
Well, in today's world, it's a choice. I mean, it's no longer the case, particularly in this country, that you have to belong in a religion. So in a sense, people are making the choice to belong or to continue to belong to that religious faith. I mean, there are still parts of the world where, you know, the idea of religion as being a choice is just preposterous. I mean, you're born into a religion. There's no choice about that.
Your husband is, first of all, you married for love. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And he's a different faith. He was raised Hindu.
Yes, he's an Iyengar, which is a Brahmin.
How did you brace yourselves for the way that your families would respond, at least initially, to your decision?
Oh, we knew hell would break loose, and it did for a while. You know, there was a lot of compromises that had to be made. Luckily, Sikhs are different from Hindus, but not that different. And both religions believe that the children are the religion of their father, so that made things a little easier. But one of the things that really made our marriage a lot easier was when we'd announced that we wanted to get married, my mother-in-law went to the family soothsayer. You know, Iyengars often have a family soothsayer because those are the ones who actually decide or provide a strong opinion on whom you should marry and when the marriage timing should take place. So my mother-in-law went to the soothsayer, and she was going to inquire about her son's choice. And when she walked in, she tells the story that even before she asked the question, the soothsayer said, "He's already been married to her for 7 lives, and they're expected to be married for another 7. So at that point, my mother-in-law decided, well, she had really no choice in the matter, and that made things a lot easier.
Sheena Iyengar is my guest. Her new book is called The Art of Choosing. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. Get to us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sheena Iyengar, professor of business at Columbia University. Her new book is called The Art of Choosing. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Nils in Fort Worth, who wants to know about studies that look at the subconscious influences that affect our choices and how that might create an illusion of free will in certain circumstances. You certainly found this when it comes to things like elections.
Yes. So, you know, we're constantly being bombarded with ads and things like that that are designed to sort of influence us, some might argue manipulate us. And lots of these things that manipulate and influence us can actually happen at a very subconscious level. So if you think back to that election of 2000 between Bush and Gore, you know, there was a lot of talk about how there was the hanging chad problem or the butterfly ballot problem, and that all of these things led to sort of overt mistakes or manipulation of the voters. But one of the things that really didn't get any attention was the order in which the candidates' names appeared on the ballot, which actually makes a huge difference, and that's surprising to a lot of people. So in the state of Florida, the law is that whichever candidate represents the governor's party, and in 2000 that was Jeb Bush's party, that was Jeb Bush, and so that would be George W. Bush, that would be the representative of that party, would be put on the ballot first. Now, what that means is that George W. Bush would have gotten a lead of anywhere from 2 to 9.5% more votes just by function of being first on that ballot.
So it's not a is that a matter of people who don't know who to choose will just pick whoever's first?
They either don't know who to choose or they're uncertain. You know, remember that election? A lot of people were really unsure even as they went
sure.
to the voting booth. And so if you're in conflict, that first one becomes a sort of emotional reference point.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to John in Plano. Hi, John.
Hi. I had a couple of quick questions. One was in regards to earlier you talked about how we identify ourselves through different products, and I think you just partially answered it. How much influence do you think there really is in things like advertising in regards to how we identify ourselves? And then the other question was along the lines of whether you're a maximizer or a satisfizer. I think that a lot of people, and you may have already addressed this as well, are really both. Because for something as small as a jar of GM, for me, I know what I like. I'm going to pick it up, and that's that. But when it comes to buying a car or a house or investments in my future for retirement, I might spend more time and really look at for the maximum benefit I can get.
I really think that what we should all be striving for is the mix of maximizing and satisfying, that we should find those four or five little areas in which we're really going to maximize. Those are the things we really, really care about, and we should maximize because there's a lot of information out there in the world. There's a lot of choices. You want to find that which really makes the most sense for you. But for most things, just satisfies. Let it go, because if you try to maximize on everything, you're really going to end up being manipulated by everything. In terms of how we're manipulated about all kinds of things. You know, like take something as simple as whether you like Coke or Pepsi. I'm a diehard Coke fan. And you know, you meet people and they really swear by either Coke or Pepsi and that they can tell the difference. And yet, you know, there's studies that are out there now that show that if you take two people, you put them under an MRI machine, you squirt Coke or Pepsi in their mouth, and these are diehard Coke and Pepsi fans, they can't tell the difference between the two. The same portion of their brain lights up in response to that sugar fluid, and why wouldn't it? They're 99% identical in terms of what they contain. It's just that Coke has a little lemon and Pepsi has a little vanilla. And yet, if while I'm squirting that liquid in your mouth, I show you the can of Coke or I show you the can of Pepsi, it doesn't matter what you're drinking. If you see the can of Coke, the happy portion of your brain lights up, and it doesn't light up when you see the can of Pepsi. So that our brains have come to fall in love with Coke. Now, why is that? I mean, it's true that the world over, we love Coke more than Pepsi, and I'm surely amongst them. And actually, when I saw this, I started to ask the question, why do we love Coke so much more? And a lot of it has to do with ads. I mean, did you know that the red on the can of Coke is the same as the red of Santa Claus? That's because Coca-Cola actually commissioned that outfit. And you know, and we love Santa Claus. It stands for everything wonderful in our lives. It's Christmas. You know, if you had Mom Apple Pie and Pepsi, that just sounds weird. It has to be Mom Apple Pie and Coke. And I was there when I was reading about all the things that Coca-Cola does to actually help its sales. I came across this piece about how when the Berlin Wall fell, they handed out free cans of Coke. And that's when I remembered that day long ago when I was there when the wall fell in 1989. I always remember that day for the piece of wall that I chiseled off. But in fact, I also held one of those free cans of Coke. And maybe that's why I'm a diehard Coke fan. At that moment, it subconsciously got cemented in my head that Coke means freedom.
So, Sheena, it doesn't really matter if we choose Coke or Pepsi. It's not going to, I mean, I suppose it can affect our happiness at any one particular meal or something. But then we have the issue of something like Medicare Part D, where there are, like there are 15,000 sodas, there are 15,000 different plans, or of course I'm exaggerating here. That one really does matter to people. And yet there are so many choices that people have reported just wanting to walk away. What do you recommend in situations where something does matter, but the field is too broad to expect anyone to look very, very carefully at every single choice?
Yeah, this is why I keep saying we need to figure out our priorities, because you really are in a sort of matrix-like machine right now. They're throwing choices at you about everything, and everybody is trying to influence you to go in all different directions. So you really have to have the mental energies to pick and choose those domains that you're really going to care about. So I don't really care about the Coke versus Pepsi, but I do care about Medicare Part D. So in Medicare Part D, you really have to brace yourself and ask yourself, okay, I've got to actually spend the time and understand all these options and learn about them and really study them and really go out and talk to people. This is not a five-minute decision. This is not a 30-minute decision. This is probably not even an hour decision. This is at least a week-long decision. And you have to prepare yourself to do that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next on the lines to Sulphur Springs and speak with Matt. Hi, Matt.
Hello. First, I'd like to say I'm elated that I can now put a name to this character trait. Both my son and I easily share these. As far as I've actually overcome a large portion of the trait where I'm a maximizer. I go by what I call the good enough factor. As an example, if I go to a small cafe or a restaurant, and you got half a dozen items to choose from, I select out of all of the items that I consider to be good enough, I'll then pick whichever one has the lowest price. Now, if I have multiples that fit both of those categories, I just have to close my eyes and point. I used to agonize over, okay, which one is going to give me the best value and leave me satisfied. So I think I've managed to overcome that. My oldest son, however, when he was younger, we would be going through the grocery store checkout. We would tell him he could get a piece of candy. He couldn't choose. If there was more than one that he liked, he could not choose. We would tell him, you have to pick now, we have to leave. We would give him until the count of three. He would leave with nothing because he could not make a choice.
And you've seen this across a variety of ages and cultural groups. Is that right, Sheena?
Yes. In fact, you know, in America, we often make the mistake of giving children at a very young age tons and tons of choice. They're really not cognitively prepared for that. Because they are going to encounter a lot of choice as they grow up, you do have to give them choice, but you have to ease them in. Up until about two, it's either, all they can really do is, do you like this or not? By the time they're three, they can choose between, do you like A or B? And, you know, it's only when they get around four that they start to be able to choose from about three, four, five options at max. But we tend to make the mistake. I'm always seeing these parents in the grocery store aisle. They'll take their two-year-old, and they'll show them this whole aisle of cereals and say, which cereal would you like, honey? And, of course, they pick the cereal box that just happens to be at eye level and that has the biggest picture on it.
Well, I'm 39, and that's how I do it. So, but, you know, it is interesting, though, you see this with children, that at a certain age, you can either say, do you want to brush your teeth or take a bath? And then at some point, they realize there's the third option, which is, I'm going to name what it is I really want to do.
Yes, yeah. And you wait for that to kick in naturally.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we go to Lindsay in Fort Worth. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi. I had a comment that I was hoping you guys would comment on. I have a very untraditional marriage. I had a very untraditional wedding. It was just me and my husband and our dog, and we didn't go get a license, and we don't feel it's necessary. And my family and a few of my friends even all just completely disagree with this. And it's funny to me because we're very happy and we function very well. But I was just wondering if you could comment on how sometimes individual choices can cause such a problem with other people because it maybe wasn't the choice that they expected or the choice that they would have made.
What do you think about that, Sheena?
Yeah, that's a really interesting example because, you know, on the one hand, we're talking about having too much choice can be a problem, and couldn't we just restrict it? And on the other hand, you know, one of the beauties of having choice is that you really can have the kind of new options that you're talking about, right? And that if there's one thing that we ought to preserve about choice is allowing people to be creative, you know, as long as it doesn't get dysfunctional, but allowing people to really pursue creativity is one aspect of choice that we really, really need to celebrate and preserve.
I think we have time briefly for one more call, and we will go quickly to Brad in Dallas. Hi, Brad.
Hi. My question is in relation to governments, especially relating to citizens in a democracy versus citizens in an authoritarian government where they do not have a choice as to who their leader is. I spent some time in China, and I spoke to the folks there, and they said they really don't care that they don't have a choice in government. And yet we saw Iraq and their elections, and nearly 60% of the people turned out to vote. I was wondering if you've done any studies along those lines.
Well, I'm interested in the fact that you observed the same phenomenon amongst the Chinese that I did, that they really didn't really object to the lack of political choice, the lack of moral choice. The same thing is true in Russia. You know, one of the things that we perhaps don't want to hear and think about is the most effective government, the most efficient government, is the benevolent, efficiently running dictator. That is, all time, throughout history, the most effective form of government. You get things done the most quickly and the most effectively. The problem is that you can't count on these dictators to always be benevolent, and they could actually become quite dysfunctional and destructive. For example, Adolf Hitler. And then you have, and so therefore we move to democracy. And we know that democracy is the best government when you talk about sustainable, and when you talk about one that actually allows for voice. Voice of the people. The downside, of course, of democracy is that it can be a bit inefficient. It can be slow. It can be, kind of dysfunctional at times.
In just a couple of words, Sheena, is there anything day to day that you still struggle to make a decision about?
Well, I think we all struggle about the things we need to make a decision about, right? And if we didn't struggle about the really big choices in our life, would we be human?
There you go. Sheena Iyengar is S.T. Lee Professor of Business at Columbia University. Her new book is called The Art of Choosing. Sheena, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you for having me here.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.